Welcome to the Inside CCW Safe Podcast with founders Stan Campbell and Mike Darter. If you're forced to fight the battle for your life, CCW Safe will fight the battle for your future.
All right, welcome back to the Inside CCW Safe Podcast. I'm Mike Darter in Oklahoma City with Stan Campbell
in L.A. And it's beautiful again today. That's the weather report.
Got that weather report going.
A lot of traffic. A lot of traffic.
But no fires, right?
No fires today.
No fires. That's a good thing. We also have Don West on the line. Don, good to have you.
Hey, guys. Pleasure to be here.
And where are you at today?
Well, I am in absolutely beautiful Northern California this week.
All right.
Nice.
Beautiful temperatures, clear skies. It's starting to be the absolute best time to be here.
We love it up there. Mike takes me to Yosemite once a year, and it's so beautiful up there.
Have you ever been out there, Don, Yosemite?
No, it's only about three and a half hours from where I am. But last time I tried to get there, there was some... You know, I think there was a fire-related issue, and part of the park had been closed. I may be mistaken about that, but, you know, the fires around this area have been absolutely terrible the last few months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But that's high on the list. Also, since we're talking about national parks, north of us, about 3 hours, is Lassen Volcanic Park, which is...
Nice.
Not as well known, but absolutely spectacular. It's got some of the volcanic hot pots, mud pots, and it's almost moon-like in certain spots. I highly encourage people to enjoy that. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'll have to check that out. I don't know if I've ever heard or seen that. You're also close to the Redwoods and to Lake Tahoe, right?
Yeah, less than 2 hours from Lake Tahoe, just kind of over the mountains there. And there's what probably a lot of people don't know about this specific area, which is a bit east of Sacramento. Everyone knows about Napa and Sonoma for wine tasting. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of pockets of small family-owned wineries in this area, too, less than a 20-minute drive out towards Placerville and places like that. And it's great fun. It's inexpensive, and the wine's pretty good.
Nice. Well, good. Well, how long are you going to be out there? Do you know?
No, not for sure. Someone open-ended at this point for a while, cool. Anyway.
Well, you will have good weather for a while out there. That's awesome.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Well, Don, we've had some really good podcasts lately, interviews. We interviewed George Holt in California. He gave a lot of tips. We interviewed Bob O'Connor, and now we're excited to get you on because we have a lot of good. We'd like to talk about your history and your role here and a few other things I think that Stan had set up with you.
Absolutely.
Sure. Yeah. Sure.
So Don, I'm usually designated to reach into people's history, so I'm going to start there. So, take a deep dive and tell us about Don West. You know, talk to us first about what made you become an attorney, because that's not what you were going after at first, right?
No, that was kind of a strange trip in and of itself. I did not plan to go to law school right after college. In fact, I wound up doing some graduate work in the field of education. I thought I was going to be a school teacher. Mm-hmm. And tried to be a school teacher. In fact, I moved to California for several years following graduation from college in the East Coast and did some substitute teaching and just never really clicked with me, but I never was able to secure a full-time job for reasons that didn't make any sense to me. One of them was that I had a master's degree, and that cost the school district more money.
That's right.
I had a job I really wanted in Orange County, and then I didn't have the skill set they wanted because I couldn't coach football. We didn't have that available when I played in high school. So, mm-hmm. Anyway, one thing led to another. I'd started doing different things. I did have a couple of buddies from college that had moved out this way and were in law school. And I just started talking with them, liked the idea of it, and wound up taking the law boards and enrolling in the four-year program. I guess you'd call it part-time because I was working during the day. Mm-hmm. And going to law school at night at Loyola, right downtown Los Angeles.
Now, were you a DJ before that or after?
That's what I want to hear about.
DJ Don West.
Well, there are a couple of different starts on that too. My first job in on the West Coast as an actual paid disc jockey was also in Orange County. And then I wound up working at what, you know, is still on the air. It's a pretty significant radio station called K-Rock, K-R-O-Q. Mm-hmm. And that's in the Pasadena, the studio's in Pasadena, but the station is all throughout the Los Angeles area. So I was working there and going to school at least part of the time and loved it. In fact, I got to the point where I liked being on the radio more than I did like going to law school. Got somewhat disillusioned by the process, so I withdrew from law school. Mm-hmm. And just as sometimes life goes, about 2 months later, I wound up leaving the radio station. A new boss came in, cleaned house, and then all of a sudden I was not in school and didn't have a job. So that was kind of a turning point. I did work in radio for a while, though. I moved back east, worked in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. At a terrific station there, WMMR. Then I moved up to Toronto, worked for a while at a station there, Chum FM.
Wow.
And then kind of those travels wore me out a bit. I realized that really wasn't a stable, secure business for me to be in. I don't think I was good enough to really get to the top. And otherwise, my life was going to be a lot like that Harry Chapin song, if you've ever heard of it, W-O-L-D, where you bounce around and bounce around, and all of a sudden you wake up and 25 years has passed. Anyway, sorry to bore you with I decided to go back to law school.
Yeah.
And across the lake in the city of Buffalo was the State University of New York at Buffalo, a well-regarded school not a lot of people have heard of. And they were absolutely terrific to me. They accepted me as a transfer student. I started mid-year. Mm-hmm. And then went full-time for a year and a half, graduated. And as so often people from Buffalo do, earliest opportunity, I moved to Florida.
Gotcha. So
that's where I actually started practicing. Got out of that cold weather, moved to Florida, took the Florida bar, and then started my legal career in Central Florida.
Yes.
Oh, now, 35, 36 years ago.
That's awesome. Now, pre-Zimmerman, what was your most significant case through the years?
You know, it's hard to pick one because I was doing different kinds of things. I was practicing a lot in federal court as well as state court. But there was a time when I was handling a lot of death penalty cases as the defense,
I would
be retained or I would be appointed by the court. Mm-hmm. And from the mid-90s, roughly, and earlier than that in state court, from the early 90s all the way through the early 2000s, I did a substantial amount of death penalty work. And you know, I felt really strongly about that. I felt that I was doing good and valuable work, and regardless of how one feels about the death penalty from a moral standpoint, once you've seen the inside of the system, and I guess I'll just lay it out there, I think there are people who do things which would warrant them losing their life. I don't have a problem with the morality of the death penalty. The problem is the way it picks those people. And that scared the hell out of me, first of all. And then once I got really deep into the system, I realized that it had political complications and prejudices. It had all of those funding issues for the defense. And at the end of the day, I wasn't convinced, and I'm still not convinced, that it is a fair process, certainly not one which would warrant the kind of resources that it would take to make it fair.
Yeah, you know,
too many innocent guys on dead row.
Absolutely.
Death row.
Yeah, you know, I it took me up until the Maddox case, really, for me to change my mind on it. You know, as you know, 20 years in the police department, where, you know, we see so much evil, and we know that there are true evil people out there that, like you said, warrant their life being taken for their actions. You know, I was just, you know, diehard about the death penalty. And now, as I watch the system, you know, I knew the system was flawed working within, but watching, you know, a man that we were trying to defend to keep from spending his life in prison, you know, over a self-defense shooting, you know, being charged with murder, you know, I actually changed my tune now. You know, I look at it and I understand that there are a lot of people that, you know, either did not have the right enough money to have the right counsel, because that becomes a problem. You know, if you don't have the right, you know, lawyer to defend you, and the money to go along with funding such a serious case, the defense for a serious case like that, you know, you can find yourself on the bad end of some decisions that will affect your life and might even place you there. So, you know, I like you, I'm in the middle now.
Yeah, I was kind of the same way, Stan, as you. After this Maddox case, I had some real questions for myself about that.
Well, you know, Stephen was actually eligible for the death penalty based upon his charge.
Really?
The state did not seek it. Mm-hmm. So, but under the charge of first degree murder, yes, the state could have legally sought the death penalty.
Wow.
I think it was obvious even to them, who in my mind were so blinded to the actual facts of the case. Nonetheless, they charged him with essentially a capital offense and did not pursue the death penalty.
That's crazy.
So that's pretty scary stuff. You're
it
right.
Really is. I didn't even know that. And sorry we jumped you forward, but go back. The federal system, the state system, you know, are there real, you know, are there huge differences between the two, you know, in reference to capital murder cases?
Well, they have different kinds of jurisdiction, that's for sure, in terms of capital murder. I was doing my capital work in state court in Florida, which at the time had a dramatically different system than the federal death penalty system. Now, sometimes some jurisdictions like Florida, for example, and some cases, the prosecution could choose whether to prosecute it in federal court or prosecute it in state court. There are other jurisdictions and states where there is no state death penalty that the federal government would still have jurisdiction and could prosecute someone for a capital offense where the state could not. But in terms of the way the two systems worked in Florida in particular, was during that time in state court, the jury didn't have to be unanimous. In fact, with a 12-person jury, a 7-5 recommendation for death could in fact result in the death penalty being imposed by the court. That system has changed now in the last few years, but during that very, very active time in Florida in the early 90s to, you know, the early 2000s, it was a recommendation system. Whereas the federal system, I always thought, at least understood the risk of injustice when you're talking about that sort of thing, and required that the juries be unanimous. So I always thought in that respect, the federal system was probably more fair. I don't know that people would say overall the federal system is more fair. Oftentimes the lawyers can't participate in jury selection, for example. The judge does all that. So we could break it all down into individual compare and contrast. But regardless of where you find yourself, it is a terrible place to be if you're sitting in the defendant's chair. Mm-hmm. You know, there are people that are prosecuted for death-eligible offenses that didn't kill anybody.
Yes.
They were an accomplice. Mm. You know, they didn't shoot anybody or kill anybody at all, and they still faced the possibility of capital punishment.
Wow.
Some of the other work that I did, though, that while I feel very proud of the work that I did defending people, there were certainly lots of people I represented that I didn't like, didn't respect, that had done absolutely horrible things that I believed had the absolute right to be protected by the system. There were also people I thought that simply got caught up in the system. And Stephen Maddox is a guy who went from spending the rest of his life in prison, potentially, to walking out the door to his freedom, which he rightly enjoyed. And when you watch a case like that unfold, all of the potential risks and potential, you know, travesty scenarios kind of pop out at you.
Mm-hmm.
And you just hope and hope beyond hope that you, as a defense lawyer, that you've done everything possible that could make a difference. Other cases that I handled, I did a fairly general criminal defense practice, the usual stuff, but I think the cases that I may be most proud of,
mm-hmm.
other than the, sort of the category of the death penalty stuff, are the self-defense cases.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of criminal practitioners wind up seeing career offenders or high-level drug traffickers, people that have committed to a life of crime in some ways. But in self-defense cases, it's often two people, often with no prior criminal history, often with no intent whatsoever to get in trouble, much less into a lethal self-defense scenario, that for one reason or another, some sequence of bad decisions or just bad luck wind up in a situation where someone takes the life of someone else.
Yes.
And then their life has been changed in a way they could have never imagined.
Absolutely.
Where they face exactly the sort of things that we've been talking about.
Yeah.
So, you know, prior to being involved in the Zimmerman case, which is the self-defense case that probably everybody knows something about, I had been involved in several cases going back into the early 80s, where I represented a woman who was charged with murder for killing her husband in a domestic violence related scenario. And
that was also a Florida case?
Going into a lot of it was a Florida case.
Okay.
Yeah. And that was a case that was legally interesting, mm-hmm. because she was convicted of a lesser offense at the first trial,
mm-hmm.
and sentenced to prison. We appealed the case, and the appellate court agreed that the judge had given the jury the wrong instruction.
Mm.
And by that I mean, she wound up in this confrontation with her husband, but they had been separated for a few weeks, and she'd gone back to the house to collect some of her belongings, and he attacked her. She had a knife in her hand, and she, I think mostly accidentally, but she wound up stabbing him in the leg.
Mm-hmm.
Just tragically, it cut that main artery, and,
yeah.
and he died.
Wow.
But I claimed that she had the right to defend herself in her home.
Yes.
Even though she was separated, it was still her house. And the judge denied my instruction, mm-hmm. request on the Castle Doctrine, something that we talk about all the time. And then the appellate court reversed it and said, yes, she was still a legal occupant of the house and she was entitled to an instruction on the Castle Doctrine, and reversed the case for a new trial.
Wow.
By then we worked it all out and she went home.
Yes.
But
no,
that's an example of someone, you know, that brings it right back to the stuff we deal with when we're talking about Castle Doctrine, stand your ground, those kinds of scenarios.
Hey Don, I do want you to get into that and to kind of explain that to the listeners. But before we go too far, because a lot of people don't understand the appeals process, and not every case can be appealed. Correct.
Well, yes, that's true. Almost every case, certainly every case in which a trial was held and the person was convicted,
mm-hmm.
and sentenced to prison or punished in some significant way, would be appealed. Yes. There are some scenarios where, by virtue of a guilty plea, you can't appeal it. You can't change your mind and say, hey, I want to start over again. There are situations in which no appeal would be allowed. But typically, when someone is convicted and sentenced to prison, mm-hmm. they are not released from prison while they are pending appeal. In some circumstances, there could be a bond for appeal, but most everybody convicted, certainly of a violent offense, winds up spending the time in prison while their appeal is being considered, and that could take a year or two.
Wow.
Even if the error is obvious, even if they get a new trial, or even if the court at the appeals level winds up dismissing the charge, which can happen if the evidence is so insufficient. So the right to appeal is a good thing, mm-hmm. but the mechanics for it isn't necessarily get you any immediate relief. And of course, there's no guarantee what the outcome will be.
Understood.
I should point out, since we're talking about appeals, that that is an entirely separate proceeding. It's in an entirely different court. It often uses different lawyers, people that are appellate specialists, because it's such a different thing. And that it's a fee that would be charged separately by the attorneys that maybe handled the case. Even if they did everything possible and the judge did something wrong or the jury did something crazy and they had a very legitimate appeal, there's going to have to be another fee paid for that appeal.
Okay.
And it could be tens of thousands of dollars.
Absolutely. That's one of the things that we try to point out here in, you know, inside CCW Safe, you know, the behind the scenes. You know, we let our members know as well that are listening that, you know, some of the advantages they have by being members. And one of those advantages is that we cover appeals. And as you guys heard Don explain, it's a totally separate process with separate attorneys in many cases and separate cost. There's other companies out there that don't cover appeals. And, you know, it's important to know that you guys have really been, you're part of our family, and we absolutely put a lot of thought into, you know, designing this product so that it really protects you 100%. So we're real proud of that. But Don, cut to let's talk about the difference between the Castle Doctrine and Stand Your Ground real quick, being that we're teaching.
In the example that I was giving, the law at that time required a duty to retreat. Mm-hmm. If you were attacked, you had to exhaust any reasonable way to flee or to escape the danger before you could use deadly force in response. That's the common duty to retreat. And that would typically, under the old law, before the Stand Your Ground statutes started coming into prominence in the early 2000s, I think, at least in Florida, the idea would be that before you could respond with deadly force, you had to try to get away first. Castle Doctrine drew the clear distinction that if you were attacked in your home, the home being your castle and such, that you did not have to retreat. You could, in a sense, defend force with force. That was about the only place where you could do that. That sometimes got extended into vehicles or at work, but the bottom line was the Castle Doctrine allowed you to defend yourself in your house. When the Stand Your Ground type statutes began looking at this issue, the only thing that Stand Your Ground does differently, there's a lot of misinformation, misunderstanding about what Stand Your Ground means, but all it does is extend the right to meet force with force rather than having to retreat in any place where you have the legal right to be. So in other words, you don't have to be limited just to your house. You can be in a public place, you can be somewhere else where you have the right to be, and if you are attacked, you are allowed to respond with deadly force without resorting to retreating first.
Hey, Don.
So, yeah.
I'm sorry. I was just going to ask, do you know when the Stand Your Ground came about and what state it was that came about?
I don't know the history of that well. My limited understanding is, I apologize for that. I should pay more attention to the history of it. I think that Florida's Stand Your Ground statute was originally enacted in 2005.
Okay.
And I believe it was modeled in large part on the Colorado statute.
Okay.
And there may have been other states where they had common law or the case law provisions where you didn't have to retreat depending on where you were attacked. I wish I could speak to that more clearly. My experience has been watching Florida evolve from where it started in about 2005 to where it stands today.
Right.
The idea of stand your ground, meaning no duty to retreat, has remained largely the same. What has changed dramatically over that period of time is that separate proceeding that a lot of states now have, where if you are in a self-defense scenario and you meet certain prerequisites, then you can ask the court to dismiss the charge prior to going to trial. That can even impact the police department's decision to arrest you, impact the prosecutor's decision to charge you, and it affects some of the decisions the judge makes along the way. The end result being that if you claim self-defense immunity, which is the better term for it, if you claim self-defense immunity and the judge agrees after a hearing, then the charges would be dismissed. So it's the self-defense immunity which is often confused or mistaken with the idea of stand your ground, but they're two very different legal principles. I think, you know, again, I apologize for not being more current on the statutes, but I think that more than half the states now have some version of stand your ground, meaning no duty to retreat. It could even be more than that now. That changes almost every legislative session around the country.
Yeah, I was just curious because I remember when the Oklahoma, it was the Castle Doctrine, but it was the Oklahoma Make My Day law came about, and that was stand right around not too soon after we had gotten on,
right.
Or was it before? I think it was right after.
Yeah, I think it was right after. It's like the early
90s. Early 90s. And then I don't really remember hearing, I mean, I'm not too familiar with Stand Your Ground either as far as the history of it or when it came, because I don't remember hearing much about it until we actually started CCW Safe.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things about Stand Your Ground is that it is extremely rare when there is a true Stand Your Ground case. Whether you call it Make My Day or Stand Your Ground or No Duty to Retreat, it's all basically the same thing. And for it to be a true Stand Your Ground case, as an extension of the Castle Doctrine, it would be the scenario where you were confronted with a potentially lethal attack and you chose to respond with lethal force, knowing that you had an opportunity to get away or to retreat, and that you decided not to avoid it, but rather to use deadly force. You know, if you're attacked and there is no safe place to go, that's not a stand your ground case, because even under the old duty to retreat statutes and case law, you never had to increase your danger by trying to get away. It was always, if you had a safe place and a safe avenue of escape, you had to take it first. So most of the cases that get talked about as stand your ground really aren't. And I think in many respects that Zimmerman is the one that most people would see the difference in, because the term stand your ground is often talked about as one of the big injustices in the case, but it had absolutely nothing to do with the facts. Those facts being that at the moment that George Zimmerman fired his gun after having been attacked and he was on his back on the ground, and there was absolutely no way he could have retreated at that point. He had no opportunity to avoid it or go anywhere then.
Yes.
Now, we can argue all day long whether there were mistakes made early on, mm-hmm. who made what bad decision,
yes.
who provoked in some ways what happened. But at the point that the lethal force was used, there was nowhere else he could go. So that yeah. wasn't stand your ground by any means. So,
and the media is constantly getting that wrong. I mean, is when they're constantly talking about stand your ground when it's when I know it's clearly not a stand your ground case in a lot of these cases.
That's right. That's right. And it's such an emotional, it's a hot button issue that now I think in many, almost anyone who hasn't studied it, who allows themselves to be affected emotionally by some of the way that, actually it's the ignorance, the lack of true information that's often accompanies these stories, that it's so distorted that it's really hard to make sense of in any given case. So that's basically the difference between stand your ground and duty to retreat. It's really simply limited to the opportunity to retreat and the decision not
got
to.
Got you.
So as a practical matter, from a trial lawyer standpoint, I'm not going to talk about social policy or whether it's a good idea from any other perspective, but as a trial lawyer, I like the idea of there not being any duty to retreat, because I can absolutely imagine the situation where the jury might conclude that the person on trial was unlawfully attacked, was in imminent fear of great bodily harm or death, but may have had an opportunity to avoid it and didn't. So they could, under that scenario, say in a duty to retreat state that even though we believe you acted in lawful self-defense, we think you could have gotten away and didn't, so we're going to convict you of murder. That's the ultimate Monday morning quarterback, where they're looking at a dynamic situation where someone is confronted with what they acknowledge is deadly force, may not have seen the clear path to safety, or may not have appreciated because of tunnel vision or other kinds of perception distortion that they in fact had a way to get away.
Right.
But if the jury disagrees, someone who's otherwise truly innocent could wind up being convicted and spend the rest of their life in prison. So I don't like that as a defense lawyer. I don't want to have to argue that if I don't have to.
Absolutely. And you know, before we get into, you know, I don't want to jump into Zimmerman. You know, a lot of people, you know, they like when we get, you know, pick your brain about that case. But I wanted to talk to you real quick about when we all first met. You know, Mike and I were in Orlando, and we always tell this story, but we've never heard it from your perspective. Can you talk about when you first met myself, Mike, and some of the others?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. It is, you know, I'm happy to say it's been about 3 years now that I've been working with CCW Safe, and it has been a terrific experience, rewarding for me professionally and in other ways. And the fact that I've had the opportunity to meet you guys, spend time with you, to do some really good work, not just for the individual members that wind up needing help, but also just myself being introduced into a former law enforcement community that I really didn't know that much about. Mm. As I said earlier, my career has been as a criminal defense lawyer, both in private practice and in the public sector. And while I've had lots of friends over the years in law enforcement, I really never had the opportunity until working with you guys to understand that perspective from the inside. But to how we met, one of those things that you could never script, but I actually got an email. I got an email from a kid that I had represented 20 years ago or 25 years ago in a juvenile case, who somehow saw the Facebook post that Bob O'Connor was going to be making a presentation at a gun club in Orlando. I did not see the post myself until he sent me the email and said, here, you might enjoy this. Bob O'Connor, of course, being the captain at the Sanford Police Department during the Zimmerman incident. And I went down there. I just said, that sure sounds interesting to me. So I went down there and watched the presentation, actually answered a few questions about things that I may have known about, and had the privilege of meeting you guys, Mike and Stan, and we began then what has now turned out to be a long-standing and very rewarding relationship.
It has been.
Yeah. And just to give a little bit more background on that, we had we met Bob O'Connor, and we were going to give a presentation at a local gun club there, and we had Bob O'Connor kind of break down the investigation of from his perspective, the investigation of the Zimmerman trial. And you know, when we heard that Don was coming, that, you know, really we're excited about it, and we were not thinking of going in that direction at the time. But we knew that, you know, to protect our members a little bit better, that we might go into a design in which we have a supervising attorney, which we later, you know, carved out to be the National Trial Counsel, which is Don's position. And it really works out to be the best of both worlds, because, you know, I'm sure Don will attest to this, that there's not many criminal defense attorneys that can, you know, that can state that they have, you know, trial time with self-defense cases. Self-defense cases are rare, but it's even more rare for a criminal defense attorney to actually try a case like that. Isn't that true, Don?
It is. For a couple of reasons, I think. One, there are not that many real self-defense cases. People claim self-defense, just like they claim alibi. It turns out, after a lot more investigation, not really to be the case. So they're fairly rare in real-life criminal practice, which means even someone who has practiced 10, 20 years may never have had a self-defense case that actually goes to trial. One, because there aren't that many of them. Two, because if the prosecutor recognizes it, then it shouldn't get to trial. They should dismiss the case or not file it to start with. And frankly, in my work with CCW Safe, we've seen some of those.
Absolutely.
We've seen investigations that resulted in no charges being filed, including lethal self-defense cases or no charges have been filed. So when the system works right up front and the facts are pretty clear, those cases never get to court.
Yeah.
The ones that do could be for any number of reasons, including there being a reasonable disagreement about certain evidence. It's usually, I think, the lack of clear evidence, because there's not video or there's not forensic evidence that tells a compelling story. And often it's simply witnesses testifying about each other. And often the defendant makes a statement that, while is exculpatory, that's the goal, no doubt, when they agree to an interview, to help themselves, nonetheless, those statements often include incriminating information or things that that were not well thought out and actually wind up almost guaranteeing they get prosecuted.
Absolutely.
And I've certainly seen lots of those cases where I believe the person to be legally innocent, not guilty of the acts of self-defense, but they've said things that were so stupid or so defensive in a bad way, you know, that they just, you know, dig themselves into a hole. So I have, for I suppose, luck as much as anything else, been in a situation where I've had a number of self-defense cases that have actually gone to trial. Interestingly, all of them, except the very first one where my client had a knife that I talked about, all of the others, well, actually, come to think of it, her deceased husband did not have a weapon. So absolutely every case that I have tried to a jury verdict that's been a lethal self-defense case has been where my client had a weapon, a knife or a gun, and the deceased was unarmed in that there was no gun, no knife. And we saw that scenario even on that case in North Carolina, Stephen Maddox that we've talked about. The deceased was a big guy, a strong guy, enraged and more than capable of inflicting, you know, great bodily harm or death, but there was no clear evidence that he actually possessed a weapon. Nonetheless, that does not have any legal significance in a case, so long as the jury believes that the person was, in fact, both capable and intending upon great bodily harm or death. Then you have the right to defend yourself with lethal force, whatever instrument that turns out to be.
Yeah. And you know, Don, my follow-up question to that real quick is it's reference to civil litigation following a self-defense case. Because a lot of the competitors push that as the primary goal is to be protected, you know, from the bad actor's family coming to sue them. You know, have you had many that went from a successful not guilty verdict into a civil trial?
No. In my private practice, I've never had a client who was acquitted of a self-defense case be sued.
Yeah.
And I suspect that when the work is done up front and the hard work is done up front and the investigation done and the experts hired to testify about the importance of various kinds of evidence, that once the jury finds the person not guilty, that there's not a whole lot of incentive for a civil suit. That doesn't mean that it couldn't be done, because the standard of proof is considerably lower in a civil case. I've just never seen it happen, and I won't discount the possibility that...
Well, it's always a possibility.
One of the reasons... Yeah, and one of the reasons that it might not have happened is that there has to be some likelihood of not just getting a judgment, but collecting it as well. So that may have factored in, but I've just never seen that.
Go ahead, Michael.
I was just going to say, I think that that's one thing that early on that we really saw eye to eye with Don, was that we were willing and able, but also we were definitely willing to put that upfront work in to protect that front end,
yes,
to protect that criminal case. And I would even go so far as I always thought that that was one thing that really kind of may have put you more at ease with us, Don. I don't know if that's true or not, but I remember early on we talked about that and we were like, oh yeah, hey, we've got to put that work in up front and not try to hold back on experts or investigators or other areas that are going to really help out in the long run.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. So Don, just to piggyback what Mike's saying, I mean, did you, as you know, because you just met us and we just started our business relationship, you know, were you hesitant, you know, thinking that we wouldn't go all the way for our members at all?
You know, I'm a little embarrassed to say that I didn't know a lot about the industry at that
point. It's a young industry.
I knew a few names. Yeah, I knew a few names, and I hadn't really looked at them side by side to try to compare. And frankly, that's really hard to do. It's really hard for anybody to sit and compare each plan side by side to get to be sure that everybody is using the same description of what services they provide, what the limitations are. For example, is it a reimbursement plan? Well, you know, a reimbursement plan gives you no significant money to offset the cost of preparing and trying the case. That's when you get the money at the back end, And if you don't have the money to fund it up front, the reimbursement really doesn't do you much good. It's too little, mm-hmm. too late. So once I started sorting through some of that stuff and looking carefully at CCW Safe compared with the others, I was immediately impressed by a number of things. One was the obvious commitment that the founders had. You guys and Stan, and just the idea that this was important, not just because it was an exciting industry, but it was important because it was personal. You guys had actual real world experience dealing with scenarios like this, and you had the commitment to making this the best plan that could be made. So I was very impressed by that. And then when I started drilling into the actual plan itself and what it covered, and looked at other plans and realized what they didn't, there weren't any holes in the coverage. It covers attorney's fees in full. It covers investigators in full. It covers expert witnesses in full, trial expenses. It covers an appeal if that's necessary. And I didn't see anybody else that came close. I know this sounds like a sales pitch, but this was my thinking back then, before I had any association with you guys whatsoever. And that's what stood out to me, that you were putting your money where your mouth is. And that's pretty rare these days. Mm-hmm. So I liked you guys. I was impressed by the service that you provided. And when it looked like we may be able to develop a longer relationship, I was very eager to do that. So let me just say thanks. glad to be with you guys.
We love you, Don. Yeah, it's been a great, it really has. I mean, I'd like to publicly say this. It's been a really awesome experience to be able to work next to you over the last 3 years and with you, and to learn more about you, you know, because like Stan said, a lot of people just know you from that one case. Mm-hmm. And early on, I was able to talk to you, and I was like, wow, this guy's done a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. And to have somebody with your experience and leadership, you know, we talked last week about we finished up our core values, and, you know, we were talking about the team that we have, and you are a person who, again, like we talked about it, you have all of those core values within you, and the leadership and experience is very evident when you look at what you've done in the past, your history, and just who you are as a person, along with the other three core values as well.
Absolutely.
Well, that's really kind. I appreciate that, because I believe that as an attorney, I never tried desperately never to lose sight of what the goal was, and that was to provide the most effective representation on behalf of my client that the law allowed. That doesn't always make you friends, mm-hmm. but it does allow you to sleep at night, is that you've done everything you know to do. And to that extent, I think the Zimmerman case was a test mm-hmm. of that. Mm-hmm. I get mail every day from someone who's angry about something they think happened, or even some perceived injustice in the case. But I know that when Mark and I took that on, we didn't know what we were facing. We didn't know what the evidence was. We had no idea there would be this kind of firestorm that continued and continued. We didn't know that the prosecutors would hide evidence mm-hmm. and make us work twice as hard as we ever imagined. We actually thought we might get paid a little bit when it was going on. But I know, and I feel good about the work that we did, and those that compliment us from that perspective, you know, that we were mm-hmm. professional, that we were committed to representing our client, and that at the end of the day, we did the best we could. So if I can do that mm-hmm. for you, then I will be continuing and able to continue what I think is the most important aspect of being a criminal defense lawyer.
Absolutely.
Nice.
Hey, and then also, Don, you know, because we kind of tap danced around Stephen's case for a second, but I wanted to go back to like something that I felt was probably one of the only things that Stephen did wrong. And I wanted you to, you know, speak on it. And that is speaking to the police without his attorney. He ended up calling, I believe it was Kyle Sweet actually got that call that night. But how do you feel about speaking to investigators before your attorney arrives?
Well, let's keep in mind that it's usually two waves of law enforcement involved in a case. Sometimes they may go back to back the same night. Other times there can be a separation of hours or even longer. But the initial response is going to be what, Mike? Stan, you know, it's going to be the guy that's closest to the scene, right?
Initial, about 5 minutes.
Show up there and begin to...
Yeah, 5 minutes after you call.
Mm-hmm. And then after the scene is secured and there's a general idea of what may have happened, then the case gets assigned to an investigator or detective, and they pick up the specific investigation as it relates to the defendant, typically, and usually question the individual if they're willing. So my general advice is, and it's rare that it would deviate from this, is that you want to be cooperative, especially to the initial responders, to a point in that you want to make it clear that you were the person involved in the self-defense incident. You want to be sure they're not afraid that you still have a gun and that they could be at some risk. You want to be cooperative. You don't want to have an attitude, be hot-headed, even if you're angry about what had just happened. Nonetheless, you want to help protect any physical evidence or even witnesses that are right there, that you could say that guy saw it or here's where the gun is or what have you. But then we highly recommend that you just kind of shut up at that point, that you agree to be cooperative, but that you not engage in any kind of detailed questioning without having counsel
present.
And that goes for lots of reasons, including the mental state that you are likely to be in that situation, the fact that you typically aren't a lawyer and you don't know where the traps are, and you wind up saying something that you think is helpful and it winds up actually being harmful to the case, even though your intentions all along have been to be truthful. So I'm not saying that you don't want to talk to the police because you want to plan your story or lie. Absolutely not. We are assuming that our guys are innocent and they have a truthful explanation. The problem is it doesn't come out the way it needs to come out, and the truth winds up being twisted and turned sometimes, especially if there are slight inconsistencies or omissions. You know, under the intense emotion of this event, you're going to forget stuff. You're going to get stuff wrong. And any statement that includes misstatements, omissions, factual errors becomes the cross-examination at the trial, or it becomes the state's first exhibit.
Absolutely. And sometimes in that they don't even remember what they said to the initial officers. And, you know, when it comes to court and they see that the officer's written a report. And of course, we always kind of throw in there that we're not police bashing because we are police and we love them. But, you know, police make mistakes as well. They're human. And, you know, you have to kind of watch what you say because they're going to lock you into that story because it's their job to write down a supplemental report as to any, you know, any omissions, any, you know, involuntary statements that you made that might be opposite of what the investigator gets later.
You know, we're talking about Stephen's case. There is a perfect point there where when Stephen was interviewed at length without counsel, he failed to mention what may have been, this turned out, we didn't know it then, but turned out to be one of the most important facts in the case, and that is that the final couple of shots were fired while he and his attacker were already on the ground. And That was an important fact. We spent a lot of time and money being able to develop the forensics on that. And it turned out that, in fact, he did say that to the initial responder, and it just happened that the dash cam video was recording it. So we had a critically important fact that was said right after this thing took place that he failed to mention 3 hours later when he was sitting down for this interview, that in some respects the whole case may have turned on. So I think that's a perfect example of how you say important things right there and then you shut up.
Absolutely. And you know, one of my last things I wanted to ask you before Michael jumps in, there's a lot of talk and we get questions all the time about choosing a lawyer. And you know, we kind of give us an understanding of how easy is that to do for a citizen, you know, opposite of checking a website to see, you know, how good a lawyer an attorney is. And is there some other insight that you may have that a citizen might not have to be able to check, you know, the history of an attorney or what they've done other than what they present on the website?
Sure. I think if we're talking about the context of self-defense, or frankly, which is sort of a subspecialty within the broader area of criminal defense, but almost area of practice has specialists. And sometimes their practice includes a lot of experience in a certain aspect of their area, and other times it doesn't. I think a misconception would be that just because a lawyer is well-regarded, well-liked, or even very successful in one area of practice, that that somehow means that translates into something else that they may not spend every day doing. So the best divorce lawyer in the world may not be qualified to handle a DUI. And so you want to start with specialization. And of course, many areas of practice now throughout the country and the various state bar associations have board certifications so that a lawyer in a practice area can actually become board certified, like a doctor would be board certified in a specific practice area. There's often criminal trial practice or criminal appellate practice, and that typically requires a number of extra years of experience, a written exam, recommendations by judges, other lawyers, and background check, and all of that. So that may not be the one thing that you rely on, but that's going to be a pretty good indication that this person has concentrated much of their legal practice in this area.
Absolutely.
You can be board certified criminal trial lawyer without ever having tried a self-defense case, however. So you want to ask some questions. When I'm looking for a lawyer, if I don't get a recommendation from a colleague that I know about someone, I'll also often look at the associations that they belong to see if they are active in some of those organizations that provide continuing legal education in very specific practice areas. For a criminal defense lawyer, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers is a big, well-established, good organization. Lots of great lawyers are members of it and leaders of it. Each state bar typically has, or each state would typically have a criminal defense law association.
Absolutely.
And then you...
No, I was just going to say, you know, I mean, the question comes up often about, you know, choosing your attorney. So I wanted them to know that. And please understand that, you know, if you do, you know, have a good attorney, we absolutely invite you into the process. But if you do not, that's the reason why we've hired Don, you know, to oversee vetting and hiring the right person for the job. And that's more important than anything, you know, from this discussion for you guys to take away is that a win for you is a win for us. And we absolutely attach ourselves to your case as if it were one of our own, and I'm gonna talk about policemen or our family members, and you become that for us. So we're gonna actually get in and work for you and make sure that you get the right person. I think Go ahead, Mike.
I was going to just speak to that for just a second, because what I just said about picking a lawyer is in general for anybody that's out there looking for a lawyer. And I do those things when I look for a lawyer to represent one of our members. But obviously I do a lot more than that too. I typically contact even other lawyers in the community to see who they think has that strong reputation, that's accomplished in the area, that's well respected within the legal community. Of course, I may know somebody that knows them just because of the years that I've been attending conferences and doing this kind of work. So I have a sort of a procedure that I go through, and then I always talk to the person and I simply ask them the questions about their background, which includes kinds of cases that they've tried. And I get a feel for how this person communicates and whether they are completely full of themselves or whether they really, in my view, are focused on getting the job done for the individual. What I wanted to emphasize, though, is that what you were touching on, Stan, and that is I'm glad to have some help. If one of our members is involved in a situation where we're going to be providing counsel and the member or the family knows someone in that area, because I think it's important to have counsel in the area where the incident took place. If they know somebody that fits the bill, then I'm more than happy to talk with them. And if I believe, after doing some vetting, that person has the skill set and the experience and background to handle the case, we're more than willing to hire that person. In fact, that makes my job a little easier. So to think that the members have to use only the lawyer that I identify is not the case. But however, most people don't have someone that they can turn to. And if you've been arrested and you're in jail with no bond, there's a real good chance that you don't have a way to get a lawyer involved that day or before you have court 24 hours later. So,
And Michael?
It's a process that we want to go through, but I want to be sure that everyone understands that we aren't limiting the selection of counsel just to the things I do. In fact, we are embracing recommendations and suggestions.
Yeah, and I really want you to touch upon that, because you know there's many others in the industry that boast about their long laundry list of attorneys, 400 attorneys, 600 attorneys, 700 attorneys, and the truth of the matter is that, there's a limited number of attorneys that have worked a lot of these cases and that have, expertise in these cases, and are specialists. And, we just so happen to have, one of the best ones in the nation with Don West and as our National Child Counsel. And we're proud to have him as part of our team and as he continues forward with us into the coming years. So, Don, I want to thank you for your time today, and I'm going to let Michael close it out.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys.
One thing I'd like to do, Don, is get you back on and talk about bail and also talk about self-defense immunity hearings, and because you recently had something that you could bring into that conversation.
Yeah, that's right. That's a hot topic these days. And as I touched upon in this episode, there's a lot of misunderstanding and misinformation about what that actually is. And it would be good, I think, to talk about the actual procedure and how the mechanics of a self-defense immunity hearing.
Okay. Yeah, so we'll get that set up. And anybody listening, if you got any questions for Don, jump on, send us some email, leave us some comments, and we'll get those questions in as well. So.
That was a lot of good information, Don. We appreciate you.
All right, gentlemen. Don, thank you so much for your time. Have a great time up there in Northern California.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys. Good talking with you.